This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, Donald Trump sparks controversy after suggesting November's presidential election should be postponed. And a warning, some unemployed people may be shut out of the job seeker payment as the government reintroduces an assets test.
I'm going to be even further behind the eight ball. It's taken, you know, a good 5 or 6 years to get us to this point where we're not living week to week.
The deadly coronavirus clusters sweeping through Melbourne's aged care centres are still causing alarm for distressed families after Australia recorded its worst day for COVID infections and deaths. The Federal Aged Care Minister, Richard Colbeck, has told Channel 9 he had a conference call last night with at least 100 relatives.
It was pretty grim. They were obviously upset. They were distressed. Some of them were angry. They were looking for answers about some of the events that had occurred in the facility in the lead-up to the outbreak.
The Shadow Minister, Julie Collins, has told RN Breakfast the federal government has a lot to answer for.
I do think that Victorians, particularly those families that have been impacted, deserve some answers about what could have been prevented here. Yes, we know it's a difficult situation. Yes, we know it's unprecedented. But we did have some warning because the system was already in crisis.
One of the biggest outbreaks is at the Epping Gardens nursing home with more than 120 residents and staff positive for COVID-19. The facility says it's boosting staff numbers and working on re-establishing communication with family members. But some families say there's no progress. Annie Guest reports.
Until recently, 85-year-old Elsa Larrabina was living at home in Melbourne with her husband, but her dementia deteriorated. A fortnight ago, she was moved temporarily to Epping Gardens, just as the aged care home was grappling with an outbreak of coronavirus. It's terrifying her daughter, Lucy.
Last time I spoke to Mum would have been on a Friday, a week ago, yesterday morning. And then yesterday morning, I was lucky enough to get through to her for about 30 seconds. I really want to see Mum. You know, even FaceTime, even through a window. I've asked them to suit me up just to go, you know, check on her at the door, everything. There is nothing they will do for me. And I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. You know, has something happened to Mum and you're not telling us? Is Mum eating? Is Mum clean? Is Mum showered? I don't know. You know, they're telling me, yeah, you know, she's showering, she's eating, she's this. But until I see my Mum, I'm not going to believe a word they say.
Epping Gardens has one of Victoria's biggest clusters, with more than 120 staff and residents contracting coronavirus. Lucy Larrabina says her mother has tested negative, but it's done little to allay her fears.
Well, they answer my phone call, and then they go put me into her section, and the phone will just ring out.
What message do you have for authorities?
To pull their fingers out and do something about it. And employ people that are trained and not just employing anybody to save a buck.
In a statement posted on its website, Epping Gardens says staff numbers are improving and they're trying to re-establish phone and video calls between family members. It also says it's working with the nurse advisor appointed by the Aged Care Quality and Safety Commission. Meanwhile, the Commissioner, Janet Anderson, has confirmed to the ABC that between the start of March and the end of May, the Commission visited just 20 facilities in Victoria assessed as high risk in relation to infection control. And as the virus threatens to spread, the Rural Doctors Association's president, Dr. John Hall, is calling on state and federal governments to invest even more money nationwide for equipment and training to manage outbreaks.
We're seeing a second wave, a significant second wave in Victoria and now New South Wales. We are still concerned that the virus will penetrate into rural Australia. So there certainly has been some investment in increased levels of PPE and support for rural facilities, but we're not confident that it has happened in a consistent way across the whole of Australia.
Can rural aged care facilities and hospitals cope with COVID-19 outbreaks?
you would only need 10 to 15 cases of COVID-19 of seriously unwell patients to overwhelm some of these facilities.
That's Dr. John Hall, the president of the Rural Doctors Association, ending that report from Annie Guest. Further restrictions are being introduced into Victoria. From now, residents in six regional council areas west of Melbourne are barred from having visitors in their homes, though restaurants, cafes and gyms can stay open. And from Monday, all Victorians will have to wear face masks or some form of face covering. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Queenscliff sits on the edge of the Bellarine Peninsula at the entrance to Port Phillip Bay. Though it may feel a world away from the global pandemic, it's surrounded by the nation's worst outbreaks. In one direction is Melbourne, with thousands of confirmed cases, while in the other, Colac is grappling to bring a cluster connected to an abattoir under control. So far, the small seaside town remains safe.
We don't have any cases in Queenscliff, and we haven't had any cases in Queenscliff.
Ross Ebbles is the local mayor.
Obviously, we're feeling quite nervous, but we are quite pleased in many regards that the restrictions have been increased slightly in our region.
The borough of Queenscliff is one of six local government areas where residents will no longer be able to have visitors in their homes. And from Monday, along with the rest of the state, masks or face coverings will become compulsory. Ross Ebbles says his community is particularly vulnerable.
We are the oldest community in Australia. So therefore, we've always from day one followed the advice we've been getting from the Department of Health and Human Services to make sure we're doing the right thing. And obviously, it's helped us, even the businesses, realise that these things need to be done for the long term.
As Victorian case numbers reach a new record, Premier Daniel Andrews is repeating his pleas for people who are sick to stay at home and for everyone to keep social distancing. So too is one of the earliest Australian survivors of COVID-19.
People just don't think of these things when they refuse to listen to the medics, the experts who know more than we do. Do what they're telling you.
Gold Coast woman Kim Watkins was in New York in early March when she became ill. Once home in isolation, the 61-year-old deteriorated quickly.
I had a temperature. I was just sleeping a lot. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't eating. I had no appetite. But the cough was every time I moved, I coughed. And when I started coughing, it just took my breath away. It just made me so exhausted. Each day got harder and harder and harder till the point where I'm like, I need to get to hospital.
Have you ever been that sick before?
No, never. Never been that sick before.
The otherwise fit and healthy former police officer ended up in ICU on a ventilator. And though she's recovered well, she was lucky to survive and is urging others to follow the rules and not become complacent.
You don't know how badly you're going to get it. If you've showed minor symptoms or no symptoms at all, who are you going to pass that on to? Are you going to pass that on to your sister or your mother who has MS or someone down the road, a good friend or someone you don't even know who... I just can't believe people's selfishness. Honestly, you don't realise how quickly things can spread, and this thing is spread so easily. I have no idea where I got it from. We apparently got it in New York, but we were so careful, or we thought we were being really careful, but we obviously missed something somewhere, and so you just don't know.
As COVID survivor, Kim Watkins, ending Bridget Fitzgerald's report. From Monday, Woolworths will be encouraging their customers in New South Wales and the ACT to wear face coverings to lower the risk of COVID spreading in the community. Stores in Queensland's hotspots will also adopt the policy. The company wants customers and patrons at its other businesses, Dan Murphy's, Big W, BWS and ALH Hotels, to wear masks or coverings as well. Woolworths' chief executive is Brad Banducci. Mr. Banducci, thanks for talking to AM. Why are you asking your customers to do this?
Look, what we're doing is strongly encouraging our team in particular, but also our customers to adhere to all aspects of COVID safe. But obviously the focus is on encouraging our team to wear masks. It's only one aspect. We have had masks in store available for our team since late March. Just given where things are at, we feel we need to role model what is the right behaviour and try and be COVID safe in everything we do. And masks are a very visual reminder to us that we need to continue to be cautious.
Have you sought the Chief Medical Officer's opinion on this, or does Woolworths have its own health advice?
We have. We follow all the national and state-based medical advice, and we do have our own medical advisory board. We are clear that this is, it is strongly encouraged, are the key words we have, and they are really mainly focused at our own team, but also for customers. And so, absolutely, there's no way we would move without taking the right advice.
And if customers don't, I know that you're using the words encouraged.
Customers have the choice. If they don't, then that's fine. They are welcome in our stores. So we'd ask them, of course, to try and adhere to the other aspects of being COVID safe, whether it's using our dispensers at the front of store to wash their hands, to keep the social distancing of the 1.5 metres in the store. So there are many aspects of being COVID safe, of which masks are but one of them. And they have the option of ideally thinking about masks, but if not, at least adhering to the other aspects of COVID safe.
How do you think this policy will go down at your hotels? We've seen some videos this week of people being quite aggressive with staff over the issue of masks. Add in alcohol and that could easily turn nasty and dangerous.
Look, what we're trying to do is make it actually acceptable and just part of day-to-day life wearing masks, and it should not be seen as an exception. It just should be seen as part of the fabric of how we need to adjust to the world we live in. So it's very important for us to try and socialise and make it socially acceptable. In truth, inside all of our venues, whether it's our LHO or anywhere else, 99% of our customers have been fantastic and supportive of all of the different COVID-safe policies we've implemented. It is just that small exception that you get every once in a while, and it's not acceptable for customers to put our team at risk, and we're very clear on that.
You're leading by example, are you?
I am trying to, Sabra, yes, whether in my personal life or in my professional life, and I think that's the key. We've had a lot of these policies, as I say, since March, but we need to be continually vigilant and adhere to the policies. The policies have served us well so far, but it's so easy to lapse. And this is part of me reminding myself of what I need to do to role model being COVID safe.
Some of your stores have been affected by COVID cases. What's your view about paying people pandemic leave if they're unwell or they're forced to isolate due to close contacts?
We have a policy of supporting our team in those instances, absolutely. So there is access to additional leave, COVID leave, for our team members who are impacted. And we also have a similar mechanic for our casual team members. What we are clear on, again, if I go back to COVID safe, is if our team feel sick or worried that they may have some symptoms of COVID, we strongly encourage them to stay home. And we will support them in that instance. The real risk for us is a team member feeling they need to come to work and putting everyone at risk in that situation. So we have got policies in place. We'll continue to adjust them as we go. But it is a very important issue.
Woolworths continues to perform quite well while other businesses are struggling with the pandemic restrictions. How worried are you about the length of the recession and the ability of small and medium-sized businesses to survive this downturn?
Look, I can't comment on everyone else's business. Obviously, to your point, our ALH venues in Victoria are actually shut right now, so we can understand the ramifications that had impacts other businesses. But we are very worried, as I'm sure everyone is, for our customers and how they make ends meet and how we provide affordable value to them is our real focus. And so, that's where we're focused.
Mr. Banducci, thanks for talking to AM.
It's a pleasure.
And that's Brad Banducci, Woolworths Chief Executive. You're listening to AM. Thanks for your company this morning, and it's 14 past 8. For the many Australians applying for the JobSeeker payment for the first time, the clock is ticking. In 8 weeks, the liquid assets test will be reintroduced, which means if you've got a certain amount of money in the bank, you may have to use up those savings first before you receive the unemployment benefit. Social Affairs correspondent Norman Hermont reports.
For Christy, who doesn't want her last name used, it's another cup of coffee, then back to her laptop, looking for jobs. She lost her position as a business development coordinator at the start of July.
I did get a redundancy payment, but that means that I am actually ineligible for any kind of Centrelink benefit until the 3rd of October.
And for the single mother in Sydney, that's a problem, because that will be after the liquid assets test for job seeker applicants kicks back in on September 25th. And that means because Christy has some savings, she'll have to wait once again until she can get the unemployment benefit.
It does make me feel like I'm being penalized, and it does make me feel like things are not quite fair.
The liquid assets test was suspended in March as the COVID economic shutdown took hold. The test measures what the federal government deems funds readily available to you. For singles with children, the threshold is $11,000, and for those without children, it's $5,500. If Centrelink deems your liquid assets are above those amounts, job seeker payments can be delayed for up to 13 weeks. Christy's savings are above the threshold, so she'll have to use them up before she gets job seeker.
I'm going to be even further behind the eight ball. It's taken, you know, a good 5 or 6 years to get us to this point where we're not living week to week.
In a statement, a spokesman for the Employment Minister, Michaela Cash, says the vast majority of income support recipients don't have to wait, and the liquid assets test can be waived if a person is in severe financial hardship. But with 1.6 million Australians now on JobSeeker, some economists believe bringing back the liquid assets test is a bad idea. Brendan Coates is with the Grattan Institute.
So it means that many Australians, particularly the kind of Australians who have lost jobs for the first time, will have to burn through quite a lot of their savings before they become eligible for the payment.
And he says that could be the last thing the economy needs.
The more that we rely on people relying on their own savings to get themselves through, then the less willing they're going to be able to and able to spend on the other side of the crisis, which is something we're going to need them to do in the recovery.
As for Christy, she's petrified about exhausting her savings and trying to live on JobSeeker.
But I don't have a buffer anymore. So if something goes wrong, if you know, we get a big bill or my rent increases or any of those kind of things, it's really going to be a massive stress because I don't have that buffer sitting in the bank waiting to be used in an emergency.
That's job seeker applicant Christy ending that report from Norman Hermont. For sick employees in insecure work, deciding whether to risk your livelihood or your health can be a fraught decision. In a bid to keep potential spreaders of COVID at home, unions are pleading with the federal government to introduce paid pandemic leave. Their call comes as the PM's confirmed he's asked the Industrial Relations Minister, Christian Porter, to conduct consultations about it. Here's political reporter Tommy Golden.
Working from home just isn't possible for everyone. And for those who need to physically go to a kitchen or a shop floor or the like for their job, the message to get tested and isolate at home if you've got symptoms comes with a potential financial hit. Unions say paid pandemic leave is the answer.
We're having some initial discussions with the government and we want these discussions to be resolved quickly.
That's ACTU President Michelle O'Neill, who says the peak union bodies this week formalised its long-standing call for pandemic leave, taking the issue directly to the Industrial Relations Minister, Christian Porter.
There shouldn't be any worker that's faced with the terrible choice about whether they should go to work when they're not well because they're worried about either losing their job or losing their income.
The ACTU has put to the government a submission outlining both your argument for paid pandemic leave and a little bit of research about the benefits that it might bring in doing that. How's that been received by the government?
It's a good sign that they are discussing this issue with us and with others. It's so important. This is a public health measure. This is what we need to do to stop the virus spreading because so much of the current spread of the virus is in workplaces.
The government's not giving much away at this point. Christian Porter told AM in a statement that he's working with the ACTU to identify data that proves that a lack of financial support for a workplace absence contributes to the spread of COVID-19, evidence the government would need to consider before making further decisions. The Fair Work Commission earlier this week granted pandemic leave to workers in aged care homes under three different awards and hasn't ruled out extending that to other sectors. But the rub, as always, is who'd pay. Peter Strong is CEO of the Council of Small Business Organisations of Australia.
If the businesses had to pay up, and let's acknowledge a lot of big businesses have said they would pay pandemic leave, and good on them. In small business, if you have to pay pandemic leave, you will go bankrupt.
Our proposal and what we've put to the government is that they should reimburse business for the cost of people who don't have access to paid leave being able to isolate, get tested and be in quarantine for the time they need to be.
And would that be the same kind of level of support that, for example, was granted to aged care workers earlier this week?
No, what we think should be provided is that people should have no loss of income. So that's, we've got to remove any disincentive to be tested.
But Peter Strong says the federal government shouldn't be paying either because it doesn't manage state borders or the state's health responses.
The states should pay the pandemic leave, not the Fed, not the federal government.
And why do you argue that?
Well, that way it puts pressure on the states to make sure that they maintain a safe environment, because if they don't, they will be paying.
That's Peter Strong from the Council of Small Business Organisations of Australia, ending Tommy Gulland's report. US President Donald Trump has raised the idea of delaying the November presidential election. His critics claim it is a distraction, coming as the United States reported its worst economic contraction since the Great Depression. North America correspondent Catherine Diss reports.
CNF Catering, Waldress Burrito. They do want to deliver it. Okay, that's fine.
So Richard Dubasky is bearing the brunt of America's shattered economy.
It's been a struggle, but we're trying to tread water until business comes back.
He's the general manager of a burrito bar in downtown DC. The coronavirus pandemic has halved his workforce.
At first, everyone was laid off. And then as we opened back up, we brought people back gradually on reduced hours.
The reality of the pain is now finally showing up in official figures. The US economy contracted by a whopping 32.9% in the second quarter, its worst drop on record. As America digested the news of 150,000 coronavirus deaths, the US President Donald Trump started his morning spray of tweets with a distraction, an explosive suggestion delaying the November election. His justification? An unsubstantiated claim that mail-in voting will lead to the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. Republican senators were again left putting out the fire. Here's House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
Do you think that the president was trying to distract or change the subject with his talk of delaying the election? And how do you respond to the GDP?
No, and no one didn't expect the numbers to go down when government shut down. When China lied to the world, not only did people die from it, but economically, the world has been hurt.
Senator John Barrasso, like others, sought to distance themselves from the president.
Delay the vote? What do you say, Mr. Senator?
Well, I think we're going to vote on Election Day and the lead up to Election Day. It'll be a secure election, and we will, if I can have anything to do with it, we will re-elect Donald Trump.
Any prospect of delaying the election is fanciful. The president would need Democrat approval to change the date. But the president's strategy to distract has worked, shifting at least some of the news cycle away from the multiple crises at hand. This is Catherine Deese in Washington, reporting for AM.
Not wanting to repeat mistakes, the British government says it's doing all it can to stop a second wave of the virus hitting the UK. British scientists, though, fear a climbing infection rate shows the UK could be just weeks behind nations like Spain. Our Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley filed this report from London.
It's only been a few weeks since the government eased the brakes and lifted many COVID-19 restrictions. Now, Boris Johnson says the infection rate is bubbling upwards again in up to 30 locations across the UK.
I have to tell you that we're looking at a resurgence of the virus in some other European countries. You can see what's been happening in the United States. And so it is absolutely vital as a country that we continue to keep our focus and our discipline, and that we don't delude ourselves that somehow we're out of the woods or that this is all over, because it isn't.
The British government doesn't want to make the same mistakes again by responding too slowly to what it's seeing across the Channel, where it's now thought a second wave has begun.
We've seen what's happening in other European countries. So what I'm saying to people is don't lose focus. Don't lose discipline.
Spain is still the worst impacted nation for now. The latest figures show it recorded another almost 3,000 cases in a day, taking the tally for the week to more than 10,000. The British government is already making returning tourists from Spain quarantine for 2 weeks, and now Luxembourg has been added to the list. To stop the spread, it's now also falling into line with World Health Organization guidelines, by increasing the self-isolation period from 7 to 10 days for those who have coronavirus symptoms. The Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, says it's a measure that could help reduce the spread.
The science on this has been developing, and also because we want to take a precautionary approach to make sure that we can keep people in this country as safe as possible.
The Chief Medical Officer, Chris Whitty, says there's a real possibility of passing on the virus more than a week after getting ill, and those infected are most contagious just before and for the first few days after symptoms begin. Boris Johnson again.
If you have symptoms, get a test. I know it's tough. I know that it's requiring a lot of patience to get through this.
The British government is jittery, and it's no wonder. Latest statistics show in terms of excess deaths during the peak of the pandemic, England fared worse than any other UK or European nation. This is Samantha Hawley in London, reporting for AM.
China's government has been accused of carrying out a political purge in Hong Kong after 12 pro-democracy candidates were banned from running in looming elections. It comes as another 4 people, including a 16-year-old, face years in jail over Facebook posts promoting Hong Kong independence. China correspondent Bill Birtles reports.
Hong Kong, up until now, has been the liberal outpost in Communist Party-run China. Now the partial democracy that distinguished the city is hanging by a thread. Authorities have announced 12 candidates planning to run in September's Legislative Council elections have been banned. Among them, Joshua Wong, the city's most prominent pro-democracy activist. He publicly described a new sweeping national security law imposed on the city by China's government as draconian. For that criticism, he's officially been disqualified.
Clearly, Beijing showed a total disregard for the will of all Hong Kongers.
Joshua Wong was among the top candidates to win recent pro-democracy primary elections in Hong Kong. More than 600,000 people voted, and if allowed to run in the local parliament elections, he and other pro-democracy candidates would likely do well.
In order to safeguard the city's future, Hong Kongers will not surrender, and our resistance will continue, and we hope the world can stand with us in the upcoming uphill battle.
China's government, which calls all the shots these days in Hong Kong, used its own state media to describe Joshua Wong and the other disqualified candidates as separatists. This week has rammed home just how much has changed since the mass pro-democracy and anti-Beijing protests last year. Anthony Dapperin is a Hong Kong barrister and the author of City on Fire, a book about the protest movement.
I think people are, on the one hand, not surprised. On the other hand, also extremely disappointed. And the atmosphere here is very depressed. We've had, in the same week, a popular pro-democracy academic at Hong Kong University, Benny Tai, has been fired. Last night, we had several young student activists arrested under the national security law for posts on their Facebook page that police have said were promoting secession. And now these disqualifications of numerous candidates for election. I think people just feel the atmosphere here is really growing worse by the day and more repressive by the day.
Before students arrested for posting on Facebook face between 3 and 10 years in jail under the new security law. Hong Kong's government is expected to confirm soon that the local parliamentary elections scheduled for September will be delayed by a year due to a fresh coronavirus outbreak. Pro-government parties had called for the delay. They're on track for a political hiding as simmering anger mounts over the Chinese government's extraordinary crackdown on dissent. But with Chinese authorities arresting activists and disqualifying candidates, Hong Kong's local parliament is rapidly heading towards becoming a rubber stamp body. This is Bill Birtles in Beijing reporting for AM.
That is AM for today. Thank you so much for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.